proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KVU Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Food for the Soul, a benefit for Potluck in the Park on Saturday, October 28th at the Tiffany Center in Portland. Food for the Soul is an evening of food, music, and fun benefiting Potluck in the Park. The night includes performances from Tom Grant, his band, and vocalists from around the PNW. Again, that's Food for the Soul, a benefit for Potluck in the Park on Saturday, October 28th at the Tiffany Center, 1410 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. It's 10:01, and this is KBOO Portland. Time for Poetry and Everything.
Welcome to Poetry and Everything. I'm Judith Arcana, your host. Each month, we have guests who are Portland poets or nearby poets, maybe even occasionally faraway poets, pairs of poets, groups of poets, sometimes even folks who are not poets, but everybody will be reading and talking about poetry and everything. And each time, we open the show with me reading a bit of my own work, sort of to, you know, I guess establish my bona fides. Yes, indeed, I do know something about poetry. And then the guest and I will read work by other poets, and then our guest will give a reading, then we'll talk, and that'll be the show. So welcome, folks. The poem that I'm going to read for this show is called Art Appreciation Later. Actually, this one is in my most recent book, Announcements from the Planetarium. So if you like it, you can read it yourselves. Art Appreciation Later. On the wall of the gallery at the far end of the room, a long frame of clean wood matching these floorboards, mounted in that frame, two large squares of silent silk, one bright red, one mild gray. Years ago, young, she laughed out loud at what she thought pretentious, even arrogant. But now, here, something's changed. Her experience is meditative, the effect directly physical. Her body softens while she stands there facing the squares. She's not concentrating. She's looking. She's just being there, being with the red, the gray. She sees threads, the weave of the silk. Her eyes are simply aimed, not focused. She makes no analysis. Her shoulders, spine, and hips are loosening. She wants to get down on the warm wooden floor, wishing that long frame was on the ceiling so she could lie down on her back, gaze up at the silks floating above her. So that's Art Appreciation Later. And let me introduce tonight's guest, who is Tom Hogan. Tom Hogan is a local guy, like KBOO itself. Tom was born and raised in the Portland area. He's written 5 chapbooks of poetry, the first of which, Poems for the Journey, came out in 2001. The 5th, Cathedral Rock, was published in 2008. His first full-length collection is The Promise of the Trail, which came out in 2014, and his second of new and selected poems is now in progress. Tom directs the Milwaukee Poetry Series at Letting Library's Pond House in Milwaukee, currently in its 11th season. No doubt, with the focus and energy of his work as a poet, the rest of the things that he does in his life, Tom is a clinical social worker. He was, in fact, a supervisor for State of Oregon Services to Children and Families for 31 years. And he's a backpacker. His Pacific Crest Trail hiking includes completing all of Oregon and all but five sections of Washington. Welcome, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Judith. I'm honored to be here. Thank you for what you're doing. It's a great show.
I'm glad you like it. That's good.
Thank you for the poem you just shared with us, too.
Okay, so now, speaking of sharing poems, yes. tell me and everyone who's listening to us, what did you bring by other folks? What are you going to read to us?
Well, Judith, I thought I would start with An Afternoon in the Stacks by William Stafford.
Okay.
And I brought a poem by Paulanne Peterson.
Okay.
And I also brought a short one by William Carlos Williams.
All right, three of them. Let's go.
An Afternoon in the Stacks by William Stafford. Closing the book, I found I have left my head inside. It is dark in here, but the chapters open their beautiful spaces and give a rustling sound, words adjusting themselves to their meaning. Long passages open at successive pages. An echo, continuous from the title onward, hums behind me. From in here the world looms, a jungle redeemed by these linked sentences, carved out when an author traveled and a reader kept the way open. When this book ends, I will pull it inside out like a sock and throw it back in the library. But the rumor of it will haunt all that follows in my life. A candle flame in Tibet leans when I move. So I'll just say that I picked that because I love libraries. And in fact, my very first job was at the Multnomah County Library back when I was in high school. So I really worked my way through high school and into college at the libraries.
And now you're at the library again.
And now I'm at the library again. And when you work in the library, you go into the stacks a lot.
Yeah, you have access.
You have access. They expect you to have access.
Yes, yes. Okay, so Paulanne's poem.
Paulanne's poem is a short one, and it's called Balance, and our listeners can't see this, but it's on a sheet, and the poem is itself balanced, reflecting what it's about, I think. Owing nothing, I rent everything from the world. Whatever I want, costing exactly what I have. No calculations, no ink, red or black. Never a wait for change. Paulanne Peterson.
All right, and you brought a third one, you said.
Well, I did, and I thought I would share this one because I'm going to reference it in one of my poems.
All right, excellent. You're giving us the footnotes. That's great.
A footnote, yes. So this is a well-known poem by William Carlos Williams. This is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious. So sweet and so cold. This is just to say.
I'm thinking of other Williams poems, but we don't have time to do a whole show about William Carlos Williams, and he unfortunately cannot be a guest, but there's a lot to say if we ever get down to it.
Yes, there is.
Okay. And the one that I brought for this show by someone who's not me and not Tom is a poem called Fathers by Grace Paley. Fathers are more fathering these days. They have accomplished this by being more mothering. What luck for them that women's lib happened. Then the dream of new fathering began to shine in the eyes of free women and was irresistible. On the New York subways and the mass transits of other cities, one may see fatherings of many colors with their round babies on their laps. This may also happen in the countryside. These scenes were brand new, exciting for an old woman who had watched the old fathers gathering once again in familiar army camps, and comfortable war rooms to consider the necessary eradication of the new fathering fathers who are their sons, as well as the women and children who will surely be in the way. Grace, of course, writes in many moods, as all of us do, and that one I chose because, of course, of our whatever the current tumult is today, yesterday, tomorrow.
Yes.
So, all right. Folks, if you've just tuned in, this is KBOO, Portland Community Radio. This is Poetry and Everything. Our guest tonight is Tom Hogan, and he is about to give us a reading. So, Tom, read your work for us, please, and thank you.
Well, I want to thank you for the very nice introduction that you gave 5 minutes ago or so. So I really appreciate that. And I'm going to read largely from my newer work and all poems that I'm planning on being in the book I'm working on, which is New and Selected Poems. I've been saying that I hope to have it out in about 3 months. So I'm hoping that's going to be the case. And we're talking about poetry tonight. So I thought I would start with a poem I call poetry.
All right.
Poetry is a supremely suitable lover. She rides contentedly in the car for miles. She stands alongside, contemplating the bayou, eucalyptus hanging down to the stagnant water. She's a friend as the serpent slips out from the mildew by the lilacs and slides up the bank. When I'm alone at night listening to the crickets with a blaze in the fireplace, she stays up with me. She laughs when I see the yellow sign with an alligator image on it that reads, "No swimming." I can take her to a cocktail party as a sagacious sage and not worry about being embarrassed. When people ignore her benefits, she just hangs around without being offended. Poetry. So, I was asked at some point several years ago, maybe many of us are asked this, well, what was your first connection with poetry? So I have a poem called My First Connection with Poetry.
I love it. That's great. You people want to know? I'm going to tell you.
And we'll see if people remember this. I have a couple of friends who do. The cards lay face up on the square green folding table, usually reserved for bridge. The game today was authors. Dickens, Austen, Twain, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Longfellow. Mother occupied herself in the kitchen, selecting the correct ingredients for the dinner meatloaf. Split pea soup simmering on the stove, potatoes baking in tinfoil in the oven. It was too late to change my salt and pepper school cords for evening jeans, too early for TV, too near dinner for a walk. Who is Longfellow? I wondered, as I pulled my mother's poetry book from the bookcase. Leafing through the book, I came upon The Song of Hiawatha, Evangeline, finally, Paul Revere's Ride. I wish I could say I fell in love with Longfellow that day, at least in fellowship with poetry. We did finish our game of authors, and I even learned who Tennyson was as well. Years later, we happened upon a traffic jam near Cascade Locks, Oregon, on I-84. We were stopped. I stepped out of the car as the sun baked us on the swarmy blacktop. The cars ahead backed up out of sight. I looked in the back seat, pulled out my collected works of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in a collector's modern library edition with the original dust jacket, and read some Evangeline. Some things stick with you, I thought. My first connection with poetry. Well, I changed the poems I was going to read today, and I did that because I got some sad news about 3 hours ago. I had a very good friend of mine I learned who passed away, and her boss called me and said just that. I have some very sad news. Her name was Maria, and I'm going to read two poems that are not about Maria specifically, but are about how I feel about that and in her honor. The first one is, after my son-in-law's death, I had a son-in-law pass away about 5 years ago, and I wrote this in that situation: I'm not ready to be grateful. I'm not ready to be grateful. They say you should always be grateful for everything. It's something I've been working on, learning to appreciate my toothache and my Dupuytren's contracture, my car stopping in traffic on the way to the poetry reading one night, our friend not showing up when he said he would. This frosty morning, though, I knelt in the hospital room holding your body as it grew colder, thinking, I'm grateful for this time now, given that this has happened. That's always how it is, given that this has happened. The Mackenzie River flows along outside the hospital. Yellow finch creeps on the nearby limb. A family sleeps in the waiting room. How can I ever be grateful for this death, so fast, so unpredictable? I think of how God's ways are not our ways, maybe, but it mystifies me as gratitude continues to elude. Acceptance is different from gratitude. That's all I can muster today. So the other piece along this line is a poem I wrote about a friend of mine who committed suicide. And Maria didn't commit suicide, but I think this is... In fact, this was the first poem that I wanted to read, I would say, after her boss called me and told me about it.
Well, then surely it belongs on this list. Yes,
to be at, to be at Kathlamet. And she committed suicide in a car out at Kathlamet, Washington. A shot in the green Chevy, parked by the dark greenish river at Kathlamet, Washington. A bullet in her brain ended Rachel's life in a microsecond. I ask as I sit at the memorial service in a Northeast Portland school, celebrating a life lived like the kayaker she was. Her boyfriend recounts she saw 65 doctors in the past 3 months. Her pain, on a good day, was a ripe 7. Her estranged father reads a statement of his anguish and attempts over the years to communicate the parent-child disharmony too strong to bridge. Her brother says he loved her, and a kayaking colleague tells about shooting a Class 5 rapid that was a Class 6 before someone wrote it. It's going to be my turn to speak in a micro-minute. I'll say the best I can. But if I had my choice, I'd be at Kalamet by the dark Columbia with a chance to stay, change the gunshot coming up next. To be at Kalamet. Well, in a different tone, thank you for telling our listeners about my backpacking, because I have been a section hiker on the Pacific Crest Trail, actually for years, but about 5 years ago, I thought I ought to get more serious about this, so I did finish the Oregon section, as you said, and I am working on Washington, and this is a poem I call On the Pacific Crest Trail. It's a little bit north of Mount Rainier. Okay. With great anticipation, he plunged his foot into Crag Lake, 12 miles north of Mount Rainier. He'd just seen Karen, one of his partners on the pack, do it just 10 minutes earlier. He even met her, returning in full rapture from her feet-soaking time. She'd had the foresight to bring a washcloth. He was trusting to the sun, the grass, and his shirt to dry his feet. A gentle westerly breeze fanned the water. The sun still lingered 2 hours above the horizon, the mosquitoes blessedly absent. No storm clouds hovered like the night before. No rolling thunder announced a downpour. A convenient log on which to bask lay on the lake bank. With every expectation of delight, in went the first foot, 3 inches into mud. Over his foot it flowed, oozing between the toes, covering them in mountain blackness. In went the left foot, mud again. Where was the pristine lake water he was expecting? That's often how it is. A charming surface has hidden obstacles. Like Dante struggling to describe the purgatorio ascent, he felt tongue-tied to relate this sudden, unexpected irony. Then an auspicious thought surfaced. The group planned to share something exciting from the day at the evening campfire. Now he had something different to bring from what he planned. Later, it might even be a poem. As if on cue, he heard another partner exclaim, "I think I'll have a plum," and wondered if, like Williams, Carlos Williams, he was going to confess to having eaten them all. On the Pacific Crest Trail at Craig Lake. So, I want to read a couple of earlier poems. Here's one from my very first chapbook, Mount Jefferson Evening. And this is with one of the hiking group of friends I have. And we went into Jefferson Park. And we went in there in September. And why I say that is that if you go in September, that's past the mosquito time. And so it's absolutely beautiful. Yes, it is a good choice. If you've been out backpacking and the mosquitoes have just hatched, you're happy to be hiking in September.
Right.
Mount Jefferson Evening. Day begins its imperceptible shift to night. The sun showers on the scarlet hillsides in the last vestiges of summer. We cook on mountain stoves, men groping to be close and succeeding at companionship. Dinner is an unforgettable fettuccine Alfredo, mistakenly made with sweet condensed milk. It tastes like some concoction hovering precariously between delicacy and disaster. I eat in grateful anticipation. The night slides swiftly in and stars shine bright as diamonds. Lights speeding across the sky are man-made satellites. Some go to bed earlier than we ever would at home, more in rhythm with sun and moon. Who are we that are so blessed with this vista of stars and mountains and trees? This question seems easier to ask here, away from the hustle of the flatland. My fears hover in the foreground, then fade into the mountainous shadows of the mine like a mole finding its hole. I sit out in the glistering cold, listening to the quiet. Snow will be here soon, and branches will be clad in a coat of white. The wind accelerates across the fetch and around the tent as the night deepens. My fingers begin to numb as I try to write. Darkness surrounds us now as the mountain emerges above the moonlight. A second older one I want to share is it's one about my mother. And I wrote this while she was still with us. Last one left. I never thought I'd be the only one left, my mother used to say when talking about her life. Her mother dying in a nursing home, my father 4 years after his first stroke, her brothers and sisters all gone, as well as the Gray girls who lived down the country road toward Granger in the Yakima Valley. I never knew them, only heard her talk about them, and I used to wonder why it was so hard. She had her books and her radio. She was alive and lucid until the day she died. I used to wonder about that until my friends started leaving. Warren, my Italian compatriot, and John Entwistle of The Who, Naomi, the organist at church, Carol O'Connor and Sister Claire, cremated when I didn't know we could do that, Charlie, 10 years younger than me, who we shoveled dirt on at the cemetery. I used to wonder until I started to feel superfluous, like time was passing me by. The kids seemed younger and younger, computers were everywhere now, like hatched omnivores, and we could only talk to automated machines, no real people there. Things aren't the way they should be anymore. And I think about my mother being the last one. So I've got two more I'm going to
plenty of
read.
Time. Please do.
Well, I have plenty of poems.
Well, you're in luck. You're on a poetry show.
But I'll read these two, and then we'll see from there. Yellow Bird is Happy. And this was in response to a prompt, and people can think about this is the prompt was to do something about a bird or an animal and with a color. So this is what I came up with. Yellow bird is happy. The yellow bird looked happy today, perched on the wooden deck railing, pleased with the birdseed evenly laid out. Usually, he was too shy to come first to eat, waiting till after the loudmouthed redbirds ate their fill. The green birds usually didn't get up this early. They were no problem, and the blackbirds were nesting by the lake. Today he read a little before rising, his latest novel, Birdwatchers, Their Habits and Neuroses. Why anybody would travel miles to sit, he thought, in a stinking bog, to watch what birds did and write their names down in a sodden notebook was beyond him. But today, he let all that go. He even thought he was getting a little sunburn, which would help his feelings of inferiority. Today, he was happy to be alive and where he was, unlike the redbirds who always wanted to be somebody else, the greenbirds who were always looking for harmony, or the blackbirds who were always flying away. He watched she wore a yellow ribbon last night, then had a nightmare about turning red for a day, waking up before he knew the ending. Today, he liked being yellow, being alive, healthy, basking in the translucent sunlight of summer for today, not wanting to be different anymore.
Well, you certainly followed that assignment to use colors. That was very cool. Very cool, very cool.
Well, thank you. It was that one was fun.
All those birds, yep.
So this one is a poem with my granddaughter, and I believe she was 6 at the time. So she's now 12. She could have been 7. Treehouse. I saw a treehouse today while walking with my granddaughter Emma along Meadowlark Lane, strewn with cherry blossoms crying out like gossamer gumdrops on the slippery spring pavement. It was a complete building finished with a corrugated roof and boards covering windows looking like cannon ports on a ship of the line to keep out any unwanted intruders. 2 ladders rose to the house, and even though they were side by side, one looked every bit an entrance, the other like a last-ditch escape hatch from prying parents or space invaders. I'd walked this street 100 times before, but as things would be, with tree houses and purloined letters in plain view, never saw this dwelling till this instant, when I was walking, slowed down, with my granddaughter, paying attention to things like tree houses. It seemed to shout, "See me today." Treehouse.
Did you tell her that you were writing this piece?
I did subsequently.
Yeah.
And she's, I would say, ambivalent about it.
Okay.
Because I have a number of poems that she's in. She was in track for a while. Uh-huh. And I have another piece about at the track meet.
Uh-huh.
Which she didn't win a race, but she worked really hard at it.
Uh-huh.
So I've read that several times, and she feels fine about it, but not great.
Okay.
She doesn't come up and say, "Grandpa, will you read those poems about me?" As much as I would really like her to. But
she doesn't say, "Grandpa, don't read those poems about me."
No, and another thing I will tell you about this poem is that I got asked a couple of years ago to read a poem to open one of the sessions of the House of Representatives in Salem.
Down in Salem, yeah.
And it had to be a short poem that could fit in with my comments in under 2 minutes.
They're a demanding lot, those people in Salem.
Yeah. Well, it could have been a little bit longer than that.
Yeah.
But that's what the expectation was. And I did read this poem and with the message about slowing down. Slowing down and paying more attention to things. And and when you do that you see more things.
See things you haven't seen before, even
you
though,
see things
like
that,
you say in the poem.
You see things that you haven't seen before. And in this particular case, this treehouse was very much, the people had put a lot of love into it. And it was out close to the front of the street. And so people at the legislature liked it.
So, all right.
That's what I, anyway, that's what I heard after.
Granddaughters and legislators, that part of the audience.
Granddaughters and legislators.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. This is very exciting to be able to do this and to be able to do a reading, and I know you do lots of reading, so.
Yeah, well, that's what we do. You know, we write the stuff, we get it published, and then we perform it for people. That's the job, right? It's got three parts.
Well,
poet job.
Right, and it's probably a chance to say how important the audience is, too, and how important it is to read it out loud.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Because we do write it, and we do write it yourself. And we do write it by ourselves.
Right, but we're not writing our poems as if we were writing in our journals or diaries.
No.
We know that part of what we're interested in, besides expressing ourselves, is to give those words to other people and hope that they will think that that's a worthy thing to be given.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So whether we're reading it to them or we're making books or chapbooks or flyers, whatever, wherever we put our stuff in hopes that people will read it, I think that that's absolutely, that's the deal.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, and the audience is so important as well.
Crucial.
You mentioned one thing in the introduction, and I can say just one word about one of the things we do at the Milwaukee Poetry Series, because it's fresh on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we've expanded into is to collaborate with open mic readings as part of Milwaukee's First Friday. Milwaukee has a First Friday celebration May through October every year. And one of the things that we've done is partner with St. John the Evangelist to have a poetry reading that's part of the festivities, as it really should be.
I agree completely. I see your notices in email, yes.
And in September, we had the community leaders as our featured readers. So we have featured readers, and this year was able to talk the mayor and two of the city councilors and our state representative and one of the rectors from St. John the Evangelist to come out and be the featured readers.
All right. I love it.
Yes, it was very supportive. It was really wonderful because they not only came out to listen, but they came out to participate.
Yeah.
And then we had 17 open mic readers. So it's when people read that there is an audience to share to share poetry.
And
with.
It's a broad spectrum that
it
you've
is.
Got there. That's very cool, Tom.
It is.
Very cool. Your community is a fortunate set of folk. Well, now, of course, we come to the interview conversation part of the show,
okay.
And I have questions for you, and
right.
I am absolutely certain that you have answers for me. one of them, or a couple of the early questions, you've actually already alluded to, in terms of talking about your youth or childhood, the early years, as they say. What can you say about yourself listening to and reading poetry when you were growing up, whether it was nursery rhymes or stuff that you were assigned in school or things that you found on your own? Do you think that when you go back in your memories, do you think that you were paying attention to poetry at all as a youth under 10 or in high school? Was it in your life the way it is now or not?
I would say probably not.
Uh-huh.
I was always a reader. My mother was a reader, and so my mother had a library, and I have a library. So I have some of my mother's books.
Ah, good.
And I've been a reader all my life. I would say that I have been a great reader of mysteries and also history. And really nonfiction and biography. So that probably was more my earlier career.
Mm-hmm.
I was in history before I got into social work, so I have a master's in history.
Uh-huh.
I did a lot of reading and writing of historical type materials and papers and things that could be projected into articles if would have taken that time to do that. And
so when did the poetry come in?
The poetry really came in as far as its place in my life now when I retired from the state.
Oh, how interesting.
When I retired from the state of Oregon.
So you really made a change in terms of the reading and writing business.
In terms of how much I did and how involved I was and how important it was. I would say that that's accurate because when I left the state, I'm not retired as a social worker, actually. I retired from the state of Oregon.
Right, but I know you have
a
part-time
practice. Yeah, so I'm not doing
practice,
that, but I kept my private practice, and I have a part-time private practice as a LCSW. So, and I still have an active license. So, and I'm doing some particular work, but I'm not working for the state. And when I left the state, I thought maybe I'm going to write mysteries. Maybe I'm going to write history. And I took a poetry class. And so I was very lucky. My wife, Jane, teaches at Clackamas Community College. She was the first full-time instructor that they hired back in the late 60s because they've just celebrated their 50th anniversary.
Excellent.
And she's here, and there was a big celebration about it. And the first poetry instructor I had was a poet named Jeff Knorr, who's not at Clackamas anymore. I believe he's at Sacramento State, one of the California schools. And the second poetry class I had was with a local poet, Diane Averill. So I owe a lot to Diane, and she was one of my first mentors, and certainly Kate Gray, also at Clackamas Community College. And I liked it.
Apparently and so, yes.
I started reading, and I started writing. And so once you start doing it, you get the, it grows on you. And my first two chapbooks, the work that is in my first two chapbooks, I basically produced in those two classes. I had two classes with Diane Averill, and I produced that work. And then in 2005, I took a trip to Texas with two friends of mine. And a good friend of mine and I went with him, a fellow who's black, and was born in Texas, was born in Bryan, Texas, which is the sister city of College Station, where Texas A&M is. And we went to Texas, and I wrote a series of poems there. And I wanted to put it in a book. And I would say that's really when I've been committed to it. Because this was 4 years later, and the other Clackamas Community College teacher I can really thank is Jim Grable. Because Jim was he was teaching a chapbook class at the time. And it was
right on time for you.
Right on time for me. It was a class on making a chapbook. It wasn't on writing poems for a chapbook. Because you had to have all the work done.
Right.
And you had to bring
how to make it into a chapbook.
You had to bring the work with you. But it was selection, how to make the work, how to put it together. And he had a press at the college, which published the books.
Excellent.
And so that was my third book, which I called Texas Dawning. And that's how that developed.
Okay.
And by then, I was hooked.
Yeah, apparently so. So now, having been hooked for some years, this question, what would you say that you get, that you receive, that you experience from writing poetry? What is your response to or your attitude about emotional, intellectual, whatever, the fact that you do this thing, especially since, as you've just told us, it's not something that you've been doing since you were 7 years old or even 17 years old. So what's in it for you, Tom?
Well, you know, that's a good question because I would say I was more on the periphery of poetry. It wasn't that I was oblivious to it. I wasn't doing it to the extent that I'm doing it now. And I was thinking about the interview, the show, getting ready for it. And one of the things that just came to my mind, and I find this is the case in writing poetry, was a reading that I heard early on at Clackamas Community College. And it was a poet, Alberto Rios, who came and he read. And he talked. And one of the things that he said is you have to find a way into the poem. And in his particular case, his father was an alcoholic. And so he had a number of poems about his dad and how he felt growing up with an alcoholic father. And what he was saying was is that you couldn't just write and say, oh, poor me, my father was an alcoholic. You had to find a way into the poem. And I found that notion very helpful in terms of writing about going out to Jefferson Park and having the moon come up over the mountain and describing that, or having my son-in-law pass away and having feelings that I wanted to express, or just a whole range of things. Some of my reactions to social events, things that we see. I had one of the poems that I struck out was about a piece on the New York Times, which I didn't read when I wanted to substitute the poems, but it was just a reaction to a picture I saw in the New York Times. And there are a lot of these kinds of things that I have an emotional reaction to. I think most of us do have an emotional reaction to it, and there's a lot of things that are going on.
Yeah,
and
to say the least.
Wow, what about expressing this? How do I feel about that? And so poetry gives me, and I don't think I'm unique in that, a way to say something about that. And I also think that it's, I would call it, it's clear and elusive at the same time. Anyway, that's an image that seems right for me, because you read a poem and there's some things about it that are clear, and you think, and I'm nodding my head here. If this was a video, we'd see
Tom is nodding his head as he says this. Yes,
but it's also elusive. It's about more than just what you see on the printed page. Exactly, it's about something more than that.
And so when you coming to the core of the question, this stuff you've been describing so thoughtfully is what you get in answer to my question. Like, you are receiving that, whether it be understanding, stimulation, whatever it is that's coming into you, that's what you get.
I would say so.
From writing poetry.
I would say so, and it's like writing a journal as well. I write a journal. So the more you write a journal, the better you get at it. The more I exercise, because I couldn't backpack if I didn't do that. So the more that you backpack, the better you get at it. The more that you you work at our poetry, hopefully.
Hopefully. I was waiting for that adverb, yes.
The better you get at that.
The better you get at that.
I would say the more you learn. I feel that's the case, the more I learn. And the more it opens me up to listen to other poets, too.
Another thing you get.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Because there's a... And the more I want to be... to try to see if there's something that I listened to that maybe I didn't get it the first time. Mm-hmm. And there's always a question, well, what's that about? And sometimes we want to pursue more. I mean, you can't pursue everything, but we want to find out more about something that maybe strikes our interest,
and
piques our curiosity.
Indeed. Speaking of that, my next question actually is comes into a kind of link or loop with that. Are there subjects that you particularly want to write about, and are there subjects you particularly do not want to write about? Either one,
well,
both.
I would say, in answer to the second question first, I would say no, there aren't any subjects I particularly don't want to write about.
Okay.
And I think that there is certainly, I find an affinity about writing about being in the wilderness and being out in the woods and in nature and connecting with nature and how I feel about that and, you know, and caring for nature and hiking on the, backpacking on the PCT is an experience that takes you up to a lot of beautiful scenery. Much of it's above the timberline, and so you break out above the timberline, and you really can see a lot, and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of scenery around here. You don't have to go very far away. But we were just up at Lake Chelan. In fact, one of my daughter and I went up there, and we didn't do a backpack because I'm not quite ready for that yet, but we did some hiking, and it's a lot different country. It's beautiful mm-hmm. country. It's different than here, mm-hmm. but it's beautiful country. Mm-hmm. So every once in a while, there are some things that I think strike me that I want to write about.
You see it, and you say, I want to write about that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to write about that. Yeah. Do you want to read a particular piece?
Well, I think of that now? Yeah.
We can do that for, unless it's really long. Is it a couple minutes?
No, it's not really long. A couple minutes.
Let's do it.
A couple of minutes, yeah. Well, it's a good example of the kind of thing that that I think we're talking about, and I was going to read this on the front page of the New York Times, because I saw this, and I wrote about it. Dateline Paris, January 13th, 2015. They were words, just words we could brush off, while getting to the next article about a failing campaign for mayor, or the latest Knicks fiasco. Brush off like the most recent Budweiser commercial, or the latest replay on SportsCenter. They could be brushed off if it weren't for that photo. My stomach went into freefall, like an elevator dropping 14 stories. My heart raced as if I were a condemned man walking his last mile, as I glimpsed the picture snapped a second before the black-hooded gunman emptied the magazine of his AK-47 into the police officer lying wounded on the cobblestone pavement, Rue de Rivoli, Paris, France. The officer had raised his hand as if to ward off the bullets that would shed it in a burst of automatic weapon fire. The article at the right of the picture read, "Terrorists strike Paris newspaper, 12 people killed," recounting the story of the surprise midday attack. Was there a motive for this walk by these two-hooded figures? Continued on page A6, it read, and I turned the sheets to find the reason for such slaughter. There it was on page A6, someone lampooned Islam in a cartoon. For that offense, the black-hooded figure pointed his killing stick nonchalantly on the way by, just like in the movies, except this time it would be, 1 second later, for real. What to do, I thought. No easy answer came, but I didn't read the rest of the paper, just the same. On the front page of the New York Times.
That ended your appetite for the rest of the newspaper.
That day.
Oh, yes. Please.
I read it the
I
next
do not
day.
I do not wish to suggest that you would not read a newspaper again. However, you would always find
But I can't.
Like
I can't
that.
Remember, Judith, the feeling I had when I saw that picture.
Yeah.
This is outrageous.
Yeah.
I was angry, sad, upset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've seen a lot of such pictures, and we will see more.
I'm afraid so.
Alas. But for this show, we will move on to more questions about poetry.
Yes.
Okay. Are there other arts that you think are like poetry?
Well, are like poetry.
Yeah. I mean, maybe not.
Well, certainly a lot of drama is. We just saw Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale yesterday, uh-huh. and that's certainly poetry.
It is poetry.
Yeah. Most of it.
Uh-huh.
And I would say dance, certainly.
Uh-huh. Say a bit about why you think dance is like poetry.
My wife is a dancer, and we have started with some of our events in Milwaukee with her dancing to certain poems.
Ah.
So she can, uh-huh. I can read an Emily Dickinson poem and she does movement to it.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a synchronicity to it.
Uh-huh.
And I've noticed that. Certainly with ballet too, there is a precision about a lot of ballet that is.
In terms of form.
Yes. And certainly expression.
Uh-huh.
So. Certainly different ballerinas and will dance things, differently as poems are different.
Uh-huh.
You probably could make a case for opera to some extent.
Uh-huh.
I certainly think that I get some of the feelings in hearing poetry and in listening to opera. I probably could think about, I'm a film buff.
Uh-huh.
So I probably could make that case for
at least some films.
At least some films.
Yes.
Yeah, they seem very, very much
poetic.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
They do. Because they convey images in a format that the mind can understand,
uh-huh,
and accept.
Uh-huh. And quite deliberately structured.
Oh, absolutely.
In the cutting room.
Oh, absolutely.
Or whatever the phrase is now that they're not cutting and they're doing other things with other machines,
yes,
which I know nothing of, but I am totally willing to imagine them. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So several other arts. Okay. What else? What would you say is the relationship? You've alluded to this, but we haven't directly addressed it. What's the relationship between your work as a poet and the other work you do in your life? As a social worker, in your case, because we've already spoken of that, what would you say are connections, links, maybe even ligaments, or just threads, whatever? What do you think? Are there such connections? And if there are, what do you think they are?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I would say one thing that poetry does is it gets you to pay attention more. And we're better off if we pay attention more. I have a couple of poems along that line,
mm-hmm,
about paying attention, and you learn more things. But my experiences in writing poetry is different than a lot of the other things I do, with the exception of the counseling. So with the counseling, you have to be listening to what the other person is saying and responding to that.
So the same skills are applicable, in fact necessary, is that what you're saying?
Probably so, yes.
Uh-huh.
So it's different though than much of the work I do in producing announcements and flyers and mm-hmm reports. I'm a Kiwanian, so there's a lot of things that you do that are more geared to being able to do things in a certain time. You have a half an hour to do some church work. And I did we're having a parish hike in 3 weeks, and so I got something
on the
out.
Trail or more
no,
local?
No, it's going out. It's the parish can go out. We're going to Lucia Falls,
uh-huh,
in Southwest Washington. It's about 5 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a organizational plan for that and going and so forth, and the time to do that is different than writing poetry or revising poetry,
sure,
or doing counseling. And it's sometimes that you like to think that you could do X in 10 minutes. So if I said to you, Judith, you have 15 minutes to write something down, you probably would try, but it's not the same thing as writing a something for church or an ad or uh-huh something like that.
Surely not.
No.
Surely not, yeah. It's a deep dive. It's not a run across the surface.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
So you really have to be able to do both.
Uh-huh. But it is striking to me that your answer immediately was that, of course, the social work and the poetry require similar, if not the same, skills and abilities from you as a listener, as a person who is paying attention to the core, finding the core of the matter and paying attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
That was really striking to me in your answer.
Because the goal of doing counseling is that you're trying to help the other person,
yeah,
or people.
Uh-huh.
And so you need to have some concept of kinds of tools to help them, where they might want to go, you know, options.
Yeah, and this is definitely similar to poetry.
I would say so.
Which I think of, and I feel strongly you will agree with this, when we are writing the work, and we're going to, as I say, publish it and then perform it, what we're doing is, I don't want to call it gift wrapping, let's say gift making. We're making a gift. We're making something, and we're going to give it away, and we want people to receive it as as the gift we mean it to be. So yes. There.
Yes.
Yeah.
But would you agree that we don't know exactly what the response is going to be?
I certainly would. We don't even know exactly what the poem is going to be, much less what the response is going to be. No, certainly not. Uh-huh. And again, similarly, when you're doing delicate, serious work with the psyche, the spirit, the soul of another person, as in social work, same mm-hmm. thing can be said. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, here's another, we have a few more minutes here. Another question. Do you ever try quite deliberately and consciously in your work as a poet to do something you've never done before?
I wouldn't say I've been doing that recently because I've been so focused on producing this book.
Ah.
Okay. And that's been a lengthy process, as you know.
Yes, indeed.
And it has been an even lengthier process than I expected. But it's been a very positive one because I found out that I had a lot more work than I realized. Mm. And so I had to go back and go through all of them. I did go back and go through all of them. And it was very helpful
mm-hmm.
to see all of the things and what could be improved upon. What had something there? Sometimes there are other pieces that just don't seem to go anywhere. And you can always come back to them, though.
Yes.
You're not saying that's irrevocable.
No.
Because you can always come back to them.
Set it aside. It's
but
not
then,
for now.
I would say for the last 6 months, I've been into a lot of specific proofreading, asking people, workshopping things. So I'll get back to what you're saying and try.
Once you've completed this manuscript.
Yeah, because I've really had to focus on it, and I still have another 3 months of work, to do.
I grasp that immediately.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, this is a question that I've just started asking folks in the last several months, and it's one of the heavy ones. We have only a couple minutes, but I want to ask, do you believe that your identity, that is your class, your race, your ethnicity, national origin, sexual identity, gender, age, physical ability, all of those things determine what you write or what you write about or how you write? Do you think about those elements as being sources of what you are making when you are making poetry?
Well, if you use the word determine, I would say no. If you use the word influence, I would say yes.
Okay.
If you would use the word source, the second word you used with that question, which is sourced, mm-hmm. I would say yes.
Uh-huh.
Because I think they all do.
Uh-huh.
Source things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're paying attention to that.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully, since we believe in diversity, hopefully we're paying attention to that in positive ways.
Yeah.
And we're learning.
Figuring out who we are, even as we write and say, oh, this came out of me.
Well, and we are products of our culture.
Indeed.
We are products of our upbringing. And so there's some coming to terms with that. That I think that we all need to make. And
yeah.
I don't feel that that's the case just for us who were born and raised here in this country. It's true for...
I think it's a human thing.
Yeah, it's a human thing.
It's definitely
different
a
cultures
human thing.
And, yeah.
Yeah, no matter where you come from, if you are a human, mm-hmm. Homo sapiens and all that,
right.
Then I think this is one of the things that this species does with itself.
Yes.
As it comes into physical maturity, there's this other kind of maturity.
Sure.
That I am imagining as you're saying those words.
So
yeah.
So we're constantly being presented with the questions of, well, what do I think about that?
Yes.
What do I think about this?
Yeah.
So we're going to go out of the studio here tonight, and we could be presented with we don't know what.
Yeah.
And it's going to be, well, What do we think about
what
that?
What do I think about this?
And what's our response to that?
And, right, then exactly, uh-huh. What's our response to that? Well, that's actually a great, we're just about at the end of the show now, okay. And that's a wonderful closer,
okay.
Especially for right. A poetry show.
Okay.
What do I think about that? What am I going to do about that? Yeah. How am I going to deal with that? And so on and so forth. Okay, well, folks, next month's Poetry and Everything will air on Monday, November 27th, when everybody will still be thinking about what we really do have to be thankful for. It'll just be a few days after. So, thank you for listening. Support your local independent bookstores, your independent reading series, like the one at Letting Library, and independent radio.
And do I have the time to thank you profusely for having me on the show?
You just did.
This has been a great experience.
Isn't it fun?
It is.
I like it. I like it. Okay. So good night, folks.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. Time for Sudden Radio Project.
Okay, I need someone to be a little girl. Can you do a little girl voice?
I can.
Okay, great. And who wants to be mom? You're the mom.
Okay.
All right, here's the deal.
There's some thing at the door.
Are we expecting more people?
I'm not sure that's a person.
It's got a friend, too.
I thought everyone was here. God damn. Hi. Can I help you?
Is this the Sudden Radio Project?
Yeah.
Dr. Nine and I... Ow! I mean, my friend and I were told at volunteer orientation that you needed performers for your radio theater program.
Yes, they said it was a good way to get our feet wet until we got our own show.
If you're a doctor, you could be on Health Watch.
Are you a naturopath?
He's more of a psychopath. Ow!
I prefer to think of myself as a scientist.
Yes, a very sane scientist. Certainly not a mad scientist.
Zippit, Schreckenstein.
Are there any mad scientist shows on KBOO?
Don't think so.